Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the El Arpa podcast. Joining me in studio, how are you?
I'm good.
That is Mary, of
Who
course.
Who am I? I was going to say.
Just for clarity purposes, this is me, of course, as well. Name not needed, as I'm the host. Senior co-host of the El Arpa podcast. So we hope you enjoyed our last edition, which was about Easter. Of course, Hemos pasado La Semana Santa de la Santísima Muerte. We have passed these days. We are now in the post-Easter period, so we have a lot more things to talk to you about. How is your hay fever, by the way?
It's all right, not too bad.
Okay, you've gone for a nasal spray?
Yes, a bit nasal in general.
Okay, so enough of the small talk. Let's talk about culture and politics.
Okay.
And society and the human condition. So, what's on the menu today in part two?
Two exhibitions and an article, maybe.
An article, frogs with suspenders, competitive tickling.
Not a commentary, that's true.
And also, do we have a rich inner life? Find out in part two and cue up, Mary, the obligatory musical interlude. So, this is part two, part deux of the podcast in French for all our French listeners. Checking the stats, we got listeners in Russia, Germany, Mexico, Ireland, obviously, Spain, of course, the United Kingdom, United States, Japan, even. But I don't think we've ever had a French listener.
Oh.
Mon Dieu. So, now we're going to start talk about lots of different things. But one of those things is, do we have a deep consciousness?
Okay.
Right, heavy stuff, no?
Well, it depends on what the answer is.
This is what happens in American podcasts, I've noticed. Some American podcasts, not all of them, of course. I don't want to generalize a nation of probably several billion podcasts, because that's where podcasts are very popular. But when you go through a heavy topic, they kind of say, hey, is that okay for you? Because if you ever watch John Oliver, even, he does that when he introduces like a topic, which sometimes, admittedly, the topic's not going to be very fascinating. It could be like tax regulations in Alaska. But every so often he'll take a break and say, are you okay with all that heavy lifting? All that heavy talk?
Really?
Do you need a breather? So I've heard that in a couple of podcasts recently.
But our listeners are very intellectually engaged.
Playing to the gallery, I like it, and so they do. So do they. there's a book out called The Mind is Flat. And I've just read...
Like Earth.
Like Earth, exactly. So he knows how to sell a book, unlike that woman who wrote that book about Geir Anderson, the Irish Pasha. Now,
check out the podcast for that.
Previous episode, two or three episodes back. But no, she, not she, that's that's I forget about her. The other is a man, and so he wrote an article in a couple of newspapers. So I've been reading those. I actually haven't read the book itself. So if you have read it, or if you are the author, which I doubt you're listening to this, it sounds fascinating. So I do recommend reading.
I was gonna say, are we gonna say nice things about him or not?
No, I don't have any bone to pick with this guy. I'm not saying I agree completely with this with his thesis, but you know, fair enough for him to go and sell this idea or to explain this idea further, because he explains in the early parts of the article that I was reading that he was ignoring this evidence that he feels points to the idea that we are superficial creatures, and not superficial in a negative way. We'll explain more what that means anon, but in terms of the fact that we don't have like a very deep interior world that we assume to have, you know, and he has said that he has ignored lots of evidence over the course of his career, but now just the weight of evidence is so compelling and so hard to ignore that he's been moved to change his opinion on this topic and write the book and this, of course, article, which is part of the promotional.
What's his profession?
He is a philosopher.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so, but I think it takes an element of psychology.
Yeah.
And even he starts off the article talking about neuroscience, thinking. These kind of things, and even he starts the article talking about Anna Karenina. I don't know if you've ever read that great Russian novel
by
Dostoevsky. I neither have I got it as a Christmas present, but its inclusion in my bookshelf is enough for me to
talk about it. Though.
I have read War and Peace. Yeah. It's a fantastic book. Now, but we're not talking about that book. We're talking about this book. The Mind Is Flat. Don't meander, please.
Because I remember you once told me off because I said it's like War and Peace, because that's what you say in Spanish when you want to say like it's like long and boring. And then you told me off because you said it was an amazing book.
Yeah, I would say it's like Game of Thrones. long, boring and pointless. But anyway, I'm in the minority there. So let's not talk about Game of Thrones. He started off talking about Anna Karenina because she... and this is a spoiler alert, so if you haven't read the book and would wish to, then you can just cover your ears for the next 30 seconds. So, okay. We'll just wait. Okay, those idiots. Okay.
So, now you can listen.
Well, a typical Russian novel, very dark, of course. She kills herself at the end. She kills herself because she sees no hope in having her love returned, and also she feels suffocated by the Russian bourgeoisie life, which is a theme that we also did pick up on in the Geir Anderson book. So I mean, if you're British or Russian or from any kind of upper class in this particular moment of time in different parts of history, but at the time when class systems were a bit more structured and evident, it would seem that you could succumb to the sheer tedium of being the upper crust of various European societies. Now, he's saying, like, we don't know why she killed herself. We're left to conjecture, to guess. Mm-hmm. And that's all we have, so we'll never know. Then he says if she was a real historical character, then historians would guess, of course, and we have competing theories like you do see in history and archaeology and all the humanities and the sciences. You have these different interpretations of the same source material. Now he's saying if she actually magically survived and she was a real character, and now she's recuperating in some hospital in Zurich. I love that little detail. It's a very nice artistic touch from the man. And she's kind
of... I'm not sure Switzerland is the best place, like, given her, you know.
Somewhere, anyway, convalescing in a hospital.
Yes.
And, if you actually asked her, why did you jump in front of the train? He's saying probably she wouldn't be able to tell you because she doesn't really understand her own motivations either. And from that platform, he jumps off into this discussion about how we aren't deep thinking creatures, in the sense of we always assume that consciously and to varying degrees of consciousness towards the scale of subconscious behaviors, that we act and say and do and think things based on this kind of deep reservoir of soul and being. I sound like Russell Brand here. And that explains inexplicable behaviors, maybe, and things that are kind of deep within us. But in reality, we're not those creatures, is what he says, for example.
Okay,
so at this juncture, any comments, any question?
Well, I don't know, I'm a bit baffled by the literary you know, beginning, because I think, I don't know, well, literature is like a world in itself. So if it's like a good novel, then that character has a depth already. Like, the author would have thought of the depth of that character. So it's either completely stupid to ask her because she doesn't exist, or she should be able to answer because she's a well-round character.
Well, I think it goes against the idea of, like, of people knowing people. Some people are very good at knowing people, and some people are very bad at knowing themselves. And so I think in literature, or even in real life, if something happens that's maybe inexplicable from the distance or looking from afar, a person who is familiar with the circumstances or with that type of behavior, either through that person specifically or a profile of a person, if you're a psychologist or an addiction counselor, for example, then those kind of patterns of behavior, which might mystify the person performing them and those closest to that person, probably would make sense to that person, to the person who's an expert on behaviors or addiction ideas, for example. I mean, if you look at the recent news, I would say that, like, this whole Cambridge Analytica thing with Facebook, where they created profiles of typical voters in the United States of America, is kind of predicated and based on the idea that people have these kind of unconscious behaviors deep within them. So I would say perhaps that's a recent real life example of something contradicting the claims in this book. Now, I'm not a neuroscientist, neither are you, so I'm not saying definitively.
Neither is the other.
Well, he could be. I just read the article.
So, you say you're a philosopher.
But he has a philosophical grounding. Now, he also says, like, that people like Freud and those were like searching for this, they were the extreme of searching for this deep interior, when in reality we are, as I said, you know, we're more superficial than we think, and that's not a bad thing. So, for example, we'll test that theory. So we are in the studio, that studio being your car.
Temporarily.
Normally we have a lovely, lush recording studio with great microphones and a golden fountain, but we're not there today. So what do you see in front of you?
Tree.
Okay, so stare at that tree. Just keep staring at it, okay?
Okay.
So what are you looking at?
A tree.
What else? Anything else?
Nothing else. There's a branch moving.
Okay. So keep looking at the tree. Are you aware of anything else around you?
Yes.
What are you aware of?
Well, there's a white van. There's a car on the left-hand side with a guy sticking out his hand.
And the car next to you? What color is the guy's shirt?
Blue.
Okay.
I don't know, it's the car that is blue. I cannot see it in the corner of my eye. I'm looking at the tree.
So everybody in the red car has a red shirt?
No, it's just the first thing, because I thought you were going to ask me what was the color of the car. So I said blue.
Okay, well, so you didn't know the shirt was blue?
No.
Well, it was blue.
Okay, was it?
Yes.
Oh, well.
That's a lucky
answer. That's what I said.
But you didn't know the color of the shirt, though?
No.
Okay, well, the idea is that when we are...
These are like a magic trick.
And look, behind your ear. A quarter. He says, because when you're focused on something, you have a temporary reality. Mm-hmm. And you're effectively blind to the other realities around you. So our interaction with the world is based on narratives that we build literally in the moment. We're an ever-changing person. Based on what we're actually looking at the time, and we interpret it and narrate it based on our experiences, based on other similar moments, but also kind of improvisation based on what's happening at the time, for example. So if you have a reaction to something, it's because you are interpreting it right there and then in that kind of space, that time and space, and it's not because it's connected to something that's deep in the core of you, because you're focusing on that one thing, you're living that moment, and you're kind of blind to other things that are happening in that same time and space, but not directly in your field of vision.
But I suppose it depends what you're looking at, because if, for example, like in this case, you told me to look at a tree, but I had no interest in that particular tree, so nothing is coming to my mind because it's not my intention to look at it. However, if I see something that catches my eye, and it makes me think about something, then there's a whole process.
Yeah, but isn't that process what he's talking about, though? Because you're looking at something that you want to look at, and then you're interpreting it on the fly, basically.
I wouldn't say on the fly, because he probably already, you know, it's interrupted maybe a thought I was already having, and then maybe I'm linking it to it, and maybe I'm just thinking of something else based on what I was thinking before, plus that thing I've just seen. I'm probably not the best person to ask.
Well, that's what you say as well, because he's like, because based on our previous moment, so our ability to interpret it is based on kind of like things that maybe we've connected to a similar thing before. So for imagine you see a dog and you start thinking about companionship, but also once when you were younger, a dog almost bit you, for example. So then that starts coming into play a little bit. And then with those kind of two elements, and probably more elements, because, you know, we've all been living for a while, so that kind of narrative kind of forms, for example. Some more than others. So, you know, that's what he's arguing, basically. So, now, I think it's an interesting field, because, like, I think there's a lot more you can kind of explore with it. Like, there was a very good podcast about, like, is this world a simulation? And even though it's an interesting concept, and we're not going to talk about it here, I just don't know how they kind of have so much time to talk about it, because whenever I hear people talking about it, experts kind of discussing it, it doesn't seem like they don't have many places to go or room to maneuver. You know, all this conjecture is this kind of conjecture, obviously, and it's very hard to measure. While this, I think, you know, has more points to debate and more places where you can get a firm footing on it. But if it is true that we're superficial beings, Messi will have the last laugh, because he's famous, you know, for not having no rich interior world.
Ah, really? Yeah. Say Real Madrid fans.
And a lot of people. But there's a fascinating ESPN article about him a few years ago on that very topic. And even recently, Barney Roney in The Guardian was talking about, how has there ever been a ubiquitous global sporting icon who was just all surface?
Where have I read that?
Barney Roney?
All of this.
I don't know. I haven't read an article about it. So I mentioned Barney Roney before. I've never mentioned this particular thing before. So, do you want to talk about the tickling or the frog underpants?
Can we combine it?
I think we should start by the tickling first, because it's kind of connected to this, and then we can move into the frog underpants. Okay. And then the two exhibitions that we've been dangling.
I just wanted to challenge you.
Okay. Well, no. This, I'll just mention this briefly, because I was kind of connected to what we were talking about. There's a great documentary on Netflix about the world of competitive tickling. Now,
it's just you say like it's something that everybody's aware of.
Well, there's going to be a World Cup in Russia.
As well as like running parallel to the football one?
Yeah. Fair. A year later, 2019. It's also run by FIFA. Very corrupt. Basically what was supposed to be like a documentary about like a viral video, because the guy, it was two New Zealand journalists, and the main journalist, he's very famous for kind of social media videos and viral videos, are talking about like pop culture, things people are talking about. So if there's a segment at the end of the news about, and this week a dog who became friends with a goose, he probably would be doing it, you know, in some farm west of Auckland or something, I don't know. So he saw it, like someone sent him this video, it was on Facebook, he liked it. He thought it was funny, because it is funny to see it. And then he like posted a message on the Facebook group where he saw it, saying, hey, I'm a journalist, I'd love to interview somebody involved with this, please DM me. And then he got like a raft of abusive letters, homophobic letters, because the journalist is gay, and also just like very threatening letters and personal attacks. Well, nobody knew. And then he wanted to pursue with the story, and then they sent three men over from Los Angeles, which were very strange characters, gave a very strange vibe. And it kind of spirals from there, and he does actually get to the end, the bottom of who this person is, and it's a very fascinating story. And I mean, on the surface it is about like tickling, but also it's about like two journalists standing up to bullies and using their resources to get information and to tell a story, but also like the weirdos who are into it. As a secondary thing. Well, I shouldn't say weirdos, each to their own and all that. But one guy, like the guy who's behind like this kind of like competitive tickling thing, he is a bully. Yeah. But he interviews another guy in the show, in the documentary, who's a big fan of this thing as well. And he has his own website. It's like a gay fetish website. Okay. And he just makes videos of him tickling people. Now, this is all consensual, it's all above board, so it's fine. There's nothing wrong with him, of course, and he's not a bully. But he talks about how, like, when he was a kid, when he saw cartoons of characters, like, being in situations where they're tied up or whatever, it just kind of appeal to him, for example. So I thought maybe that's an example of something that maybe defines somebody's life, and decisions that they make are based kind of off that kind of that worldview or that kind of defining characteristic of their personality, because like that's his job basically now to make these kind of videos, is kind of something that's, there's no logic to it in a sense, in terms of like he doesn't know where it comes from, but he just knew that from a very young age he had that interest in that particular thing of like watching and performing tickling actions. Yeah, so I don't know, so you can attack it from lots of different ways, but if you haven't seen it, I would recommend that documentary as well. Now, what have I explained to you about frogs in underpants?
That then they turn into suspenders.
Not the frogs.
No, the underpants. Or they get like suspenders added to them.
Do you know what's weird actually? I completely forgot about this, but it just popped into my mind because I thought you were talking about the frogs turning into suspenders.
And?
Do you know animal transformation, which you spoke about in another podcast?
Yes, a long time ago.
Like Socrates and all great philosophers felt that animals change into other animals because they couldn't understand concepts of migration or hibernation. So basic like biological facts about these animals were interpreted by very intelligent people in terms of like this animal changed into another animal, or even a certain type of fish came from mud. So like a mud forming an animal.
Of course.
So but yeah, so no, you don't remember. I told you this like 2 hours ago.
Yes, I remember. I just don't want to repeat it.
Why not? Okay, I'll repeat it. Okay, so basically it involves frog sperm. So when a lady frog and a boy frog fall in love, they hug in a special way, and the male frog mounts the female frog.
Summing up.
And obviously a liquid is excreted, and that's the baby fluid that interacts with another part of the lady frog, and magic happens 9 months later, and a frog stork delivers the frog baby.
9 months later.
I don't know how frogs, I don't know their pregnancy terms, treat it, was trimesters or whatever.
They're not mammals.
And they lay eggs. I don't know. Whatever they do. Alright? Okay. So obviously in the water it would wash away the sperm. So what this some people did was like they put like pants on the frog. And
some people.
Just random people. So I think one pants was made out of like pig's bladder, so it just kinda dissolved in the water. And then the other, like the water would just would make the pants kinda like just fall off anyway and disappear. Like float away. So basically they put suspenders on the underpants so that like the fluid could be caught by the pants, and they could analyze it, for example, afterwards, which is pretty amazing, you know.
I hope nobody's having lunch while listening to this.
Well, it depends if they're eating frog's legs, no? But since we don't have any French listeners,
thank God.
See, a casual coincidence of comedy in part one can be a racist joke in part two. I wasn't even planning that. Okay, so I've done a lot of talking. I will, of course, talk about the two exhibitions, but what about you've done talking too? Don't worry.
No, I thought you wanted to give my opinion on the frog.
No, don't worry. Frog sperm is neutral. There's no need to give an opinion about that. But we've seen two exhibitions. The first one, Take It Away, Captain Mary. What's the story?
Okay, so we've seen two exhibitions, both of them in like Fundación Mafre, which is another one of the foundations in Madrid. Belongs to an insurance company. And well, I think the prior assessment to actually seeing it was quite accurate, because I didn't think we were going to be too keen on the paintings, and I thought we were going to be alright on the photos, but not terribly impressed.
Okay, which has been the case.
I think so.
Has been the case indeed. Now, from the first exhibition, was there any painting that you liked? Well, what was the basis of the
exhibition was about the friendship between three artists, which are
a frog and its suspenders.
Balthos, I don't know how you pronounce it, to be honest.
Doesn't matter.
Giacometti. Mm-hmm. And Derain.
Okay. Or
Derain, because he's French. That's it. It helps that I've got like
We don't have any French listeners.
I know, it's getting worse. Okay. And basically, well, he talked about how the three of them, although they have different styles, focused on the same things, like they had the same motivation behind their works of art, and they were really good friends, and they influenced each other and so on. And did I like any paintings? I mean, I don't know. Whenever we go to that gallery, it's like I don't really find anything that's very much for me, which is quite frustrating. Because I really, even if it's not, you know, something that I find aesthetically pleasing, I actually try and find some depth in it or something to learn about it. I don't know. I think probably the most interesting thing was a painting that, the painting that depicted a woman looking, or a young man looking at a table with a white cloth.
Whoa, that was my interpretation.
Yes, I was just about to say that the only reason why I found it more interesting is because you told me about a different way of looking at it, which I hadn't thought of, and then I actually started seeing it that way, like it was plausible. And then it sort of like had more of a meaning, I would say. I don't know if it's the one that it's meant to have, or you know, it was a work of your imagination, but I bought into it and actually added something to it. Other than that, not terribly forced, to be honest. And I don't know, if you like that style, maybe you just like it, or maybe we're missing, I have to say that the exhibition is free, but what they do is they sell these audio guides that are supposed to explain. There aren't a lot of explanations on the walls or anything. There are some bits, but they don't really help you understand. So maybe in the audio guides it actually gives you an explanation that helps you. And maybe that would add some more into it, but not something that really speaks to me.
Okay. Very good. Well, my interpretation of that painting was, you didn't believe me. You thought I was talking bollocks.
No.
At the start,
yes.
the description was how, like, you couldn't tell if where it was, the gender of the person. It was about creating spaces.
Yeah.
And, like, not really knowing where you were and things being suspended. So there was a knife kind of in a loaf of bread that was kind of suspended. And also apples in an apple dish that were also seemingly suspended as well. Now, it does from afar look like a person looking into a coffin, because the brown of the table would suggest that. The look on the face, this kind of like momentary gaze at something that's going to be put away.
Yeah.
And kind of lifting back of the curtain that was on the wall behind the table does seemingly look like has the heaviness of the lid of a coffin as well. Now, to quote Psalm 144:4, man's life is a breath, it passes like a shadow.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. I saw that in the Andy Warhol. I didn't go to the exhibition, I just read some literature about it, and that was the opening statement. Again, you know, this suspension of things that are going to disappear, these temporary things, which of course are represented very elementally by food stuff, I think would lend itself quite well to this reading of a scene of a funereal coffin gazing kitchen table of Russell Brand again. Okay, so now there was another one that was just of fruit, and now I hate pictures of fruit.
Yes, me too.
With a passion fruit.
Fruit.
Yes. But I like this one in a sense because, like, I read in the description on one of the walls that one of the painters was blown away by a picture of three pears at a table, and he just loved it.
It's a shame they cannot see you rolling your eyes.
I'm sure they can hear it. But you know, to be fair, I can, like, cinematically, there are movies that either start, you know, their intros could be like these, focusing on scenes like this where it's very familial, or there's food, or there's flowers, and you just see the table or the hands, or something like from that perspective. So I think cinematically, one could appreciate it, but would I want to see a table full of bananas again? No, probably not. So I think the biggest thing, there's a few portraits that were nice as well, but I think the biggest thing is like that they're painting the 1920s, and seemingly were very design, that designs and painting like they're painting the 1400s with some of them.
Yeah,
so very kind of bland paintings with no strong colors or depth. Really very flat in lots of different ways, and you know, I think you know, it is what it is, and unfortunately for us it ain't much. For example, so
no.
What can you do? So roll on, exhibition numero dos.
Yes, so that exhibition was in the other Fundación Mapfre, and it was by a photographer, Dutch photographer, that I'm not sure I'm going to try and say his surname.
It's very easy. It's Ed van der Elsken.
Okay, well, I suppose maybe that's right. Or not. But yes, Dutch photographer, and basically, well, there are a lot of like pop culture scenes, then there are randomly, there's a series of like photos of a world trip that he took with his wife, where he kind of like took half anthropological pictures in Africa, and then a right mixture of like pictures in Japan. I'm not selling him very much. I wasn't very fussed, to be honest. I you know, like how in other exhibitions there have been things that have spoken to us about people or about feelings, and I think this is mostly about culture, and I don't know. It's about a certain aspect of culture that perhaps I'm not that interested in.
Like Japanese lovemaking.
Like the emptiness of like
Japanese lovemaking.
60s
Japanese lovemaking.
Vice.
Which includes Japanese lovemaking.
Yes, I don't know. It's just, I mean, I don't know. It didn't say very much to me.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, some of the stuff was interesting in terms of pop culture because they mentioned his contact sheets. Now, there's a new exhibition somewhere in the world based on these contact photos, which are photos that people take of musicians when they photograph them. And they choose one of the images for publication, for a magazine or for whatever. But these contact sheet photos are all the photos they took. So yes. from beginning to finish. And we've spoken about that before, about how there's one picture of Margaret Thatcher where, like, maybe 10 seconds earlier she looked happy. 10 seconds later she looks how she usually looks. Like she's internalizing a fart. How they chose that one and didn't choose the other images, for example.
We have a podcast about this.
Internalizing gases. Exactly.
That as well.
If not, we'll have one soon. And basically, you know, just a fascinating way of like how somebody can change in a very short period of time, their mental state or how they look, for example. Bob Marley, a lot of his most famous photographs come from one particular studio session, and he only did a very few, you know, he spent very little time in those kind of shoots because he felt they were too forced and too formal. And they have stuff about Bjork and Oasis because the same photographer snapped a lot of them. Also snapped pictures of Joy Division, which there aren't that many photographs of them. The photographer himself says, like, technically a lot of those photographs aren't really good, but you can see, like, things happening, even Ian Curtis smiling, which I guess we haven't seen too many photographs of that, or people coming out of a shower with a towel, for example. So again, just this kind of like the humdrum of this band on the road, for example, which is, I think, is interesting because like the lyrics obviously were very profound and very deep, but even the old musicians in the band didn't fully understand them and just felt, oh, he's just writing whatever, you know. And after he killed himself, they kind of realized, okay, maybe there's a bit more going on. So, you know, in a sense, like you had this kind of like you had Ian Curtis, who was very had problems with mental health and thought very deeply, I think, about a lot of things, and then just like these lads from England just mucking around having a laugh, for example. So, and even the photographer, they mentioned in this exhibition that he would like say, "Hey, beautiful," from behind the camera and kind of like provoke his subjects. Well, the same photographer would do the same and go, like, if you supported Arsenal, he'd go, "Aren't Chelsea way better than Arsenal?" And like just kind of provoke discussion, various emotional states, and then snap, 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 for example. So, so like, you know, I think it's relevant because like he loved photographing this Elskin guy, like kind of young rebels and things like this. So it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of empty, well, depending on how they use it, but commodification and commercialization of youth and power and beauty, you know, these are things that we still see. If you're buying the enemy in the 90s, you'd see this. If you are following whatever publication or blog or Instagram now, it's still kind of the same thing, for example. So, you know, at least
that's probably what I don't like about it.
Yeah, but if you look at, like, I mentioned Andy Warhol, like his stuff kind of pop art, and apparently there's like letters from Francis Bacon which were discovered recently where he said, "Oh, that Warhol stuff is terribly bad." And it is, because, like, I don't know if really, like, he has a famous photograph of boxes on top of each other, cardboard boxes, and supposed to, like, suggest our over reliance on cardboard and plastic and all that kind of stuff. But at least like this is like, you know, depending on the person and how you take a photograph, it can say something, because when you photograph people, they can transmit something.
Yeah.
But at least it kind of serves a purpose, like where it is kind of like advertising, because and Andy Warhol's time, advertising and art were very closely linked. But the way he kind of chose to interpret it, I think always leaves me cold. While sometimes if you get a picture of a charismatic person or with the right light, it can tell a story, and ultimately that's what Elskin wanted to do, and sometimes I think he did achieve that.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree, there's always something worse
for that. Advice for life. Keep your chins up, kids. So anything else you want to say?
No.
Never try. It could always be worse. It probably will be.
Yes.
Okay.
That's my last thing.
Okay, well, in that case, it's been a very long part two, a very short part one, and what proves to be a very short part three, and you will hear that after the obligatory musical interlude.
To speak loud.
Oh, we're on air, so thank you for listening to part two. For that listener who keeps complaining and writing in, you heard it from the horse's mouth. She's trying her best to sound on top of her lungs and audible for everybody. So thank you very much for listening to this special edition of the Elabra podcast. And you know why it's special? Because every time I do it with you, it is special.
Aww.
So... me out of the bad books for leaving for Ireland last week. So find us at LARPA1 on Twitter, LARPA on Instagram, that's LARPA Media I should say, LARPAmedia.com is our website, and you can find us on YouTube on /LARPA Media as well for a lot more videos that we've been uploading over the last few days, including some promotions for our audio guides and our app. And you have anything archaeological to say? Okay, we'll leave it there then. So, join us next week for the latest edition of the Elabra podcast. Wait, no, you've time to take down. Do you have anything to say?
No.
We'll leave it there then.
If you give me some time to think, I might go up with something.
Don't worry, well, we've actually recorded part three before part two, naughty us. So, if you think of it, you can surreptitiously slip it into part two, even though chronologically in the story of the podcast. It wouldn't make any sense. So, anyway, to say goodbye, sure. Go on, say it.
Okay, bye.
I say goodbye. Good luck. The Elabra Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.